Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two interviews today on almost antonymic subjects. First, Yasha Levine will talk about the current obsession with encrypting communications, the urge to hide, and Elaine Tobin will talk about the politics of celebrity, which is quite the opposite of hiding. First, Yasha Levine. Suddenly, half my friends are afraid of using normal internet texting programs and want something that's strongly encrypted, like Signal. What are these programs, and why the obsession? Here's the journalist Yasha Levine, who's in Russia right now, finishing up his book Surveillance Valley, which is about how the tech industry turned the internet into the greatest surveillance apparatus in history. It will be out from Public Affairs Books late this year. Yasha Levine. There's an obsession now with encrypted communications, I guess is the term we want to use, among activists and even writers and editors and people like that who now in Trump's America want to communicate secretly. You've been studying all this stuff. You know, first lay out, what are the issues involved in encrypting communications?
It's been interesting to see. Definitely after Trump's victory, there has been a huge uptick in interest in encrypting messages between people, and you know, leading privacy activists and experts have really started urging Americans to encrypt everything that they possibly can, starting with the text that they send each other, trying to anonymize their web traffic, because they think that it'll protect us from a kind of a totalitarian Trump presidency that, you know, seeks to control us all. I mean, what's been interesting about it, and it's rather kind of disturbing and worrying to me, because I've been covering this for about 4 years, the dark side of anonymity and encryption technology, is that most of the apps that are suggested that people use to protect themselves from the incoming administration and from essentially the U.S. government, these apps are themselves a creation of the U.S. government. They are apps that were created by the U.S. national security state and are funded now by the same government that they're supposed to protect us from.
All right, let's talk about a couple of these things. First, Tor, the browser. What's that about?
Tor entered mainstream discourse after Edward Snowden came on the scene. You know, when some of the first images that we saw of him sitting in Hong Kong showed him with a laptop, and he had kind of a giant oval sticker on his laptop that said Tor, with a kind of onion that is Tor's logo. Tor is a really popular app that's supposed to anonymize your internet browsing. You use it instead of your normal browser. And what the app does is it redirects your traffic through several other layers of servers and nodes and bounces it around as to sort of confuse the origin and the destination of your traffic. So someone observing your internet connection won't know, you know, that you're downloading Doug Henwood's podcast, right, from his website. All they see is that you're entering this sort of Tor network, and they don't know where you're going from that, right? It's a really, really, really popular piece of software. And another thing that it does is it powers the dark web, these illegal marketplaces like Silk Road, where you can buy drugs, child pornography, and where you can buy, guns and whatever else you can buy there, and where terrorist groups have their own kind of forums and recruiting resources in this dark web. So this piece of software allows you to anonymously browse the internet, but it also allows people to host their websites anonymously on the internet. So when the FBI comes looking at, like, who owns this website, they can't actually pierce the veil. So all they see is this thing exists on the dark web, and it disconnects the physical server on which this information actually sits from its internet presence.
But now they say somehow managed to bust Silk Road. How did they do that?
That's kind of an issue of, there's an ongoing dispute about that. And I mean, I think it's basically that Ross Ulbricht, the guy who started it, a young Texan kid who was a libertarian and who believed that this kind of encryption technology can save us from big government and protect us and create an island, like a utopian libertarian island on the internet that has no laws, no tax codes, no regulations and things like that. He made a bunch of really bad mistakes where he, at some point, before he really got going, he posted an email of his that on some, you know, public internet forum looking for developers. And then that email was then traced back to him, to the dark web. And so I think an FBI agent actually could see correlate something that existed on the public web to something that existed on this dark web and see that it's the same address. They started piecing together the case. But there were other things, you know, during the trial, it turned out that he kept a diary of his work and what he did to keep the website running and all his journey documenting his career as a dark web drug lord. He kept saying that, you know, that my Tor server kept crashing and it kept leaking my real IP address. So the software is not bug proof by any means. And so that might have been another way that the FBI finally got to him. But, you know, I mean, the most interesting thing about the Tor project, right, is that on the one hand, the people who promote it and the people who produce it say that it can protect you from the U.S. government, that it can offer anonymity, and that whether it's the FBI or the Department of Homeland Security or the National Security Agency or the CIA, whoever is looking at your internet connection cannot observe you. But if you look at the history of the Tor project, and you actually see that it was created by the U.S. Navy and is still funded by the U.S. Navy, and it is funded by several other organizations, including the State Department and an old CIA spinoff called the Broadcasting Board of Governors.
When I hear that, I think, you know, if the U.S. government funds this thing, they're going to want some kind of backdoor into it that they can tap it. And all these tech experts tell me I'm just a naive person, and I really don't understand how complex this technology is. And it's all open source, so all the geese can read it and find out that nothing fishy is going on. Am I being just having too much faith in the power of the U.S. government to think that maybe they left a backdoor open for their access?
You know, a backdoor isn't necessary. I don't like to make the claims of that there's probably a backdoor because there's no evidence of a backdoor. And it was so far, right? We have no evidence of that. And to be honest, Tor doesn't require a backdoor for the NSA to completely own it. The fact is that, I mean, not a month that doesn't go by without Tor announcing that, oops, you know, we found another hole that could potentially allow the U.S. government to completely own our networks. But hey, don't worry about it because, you know, we finally patched it and everything should be okay now. But, you know, for the past 5 years or whatever, that hole had been completely wide open and potentially exploited by any intelligence agency in the world. You know, not just American intelligence, but Chinese, Russian, Iranian, Saudi, whatever, right? And so there isn't a backdoor just because there isn't any evidence of a backdoor. But a backdoor isn't required for the U.S. government to penetrate it because the NSA has essentially unlimited resources, right? And Tor is maintained by a small group of people, maybe a dozen people maximum, right? Whereas, you know, the NSA has thousands of engineers and cryptographers looking for weaknesses and poking holes in the thing. So it's not even necessary, I'd say, because there are so many bugs in this code that are constantly being found that it's one of these arguments that people have over them. It's like, well, if the U.S. government funds it, well, show me the back door, show me the back door. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, and this is something that we see with the DNC email hack, is that our computer systems and network systems are so complicated and sophisticated and have so many moving parts and are connected together in different ways that you can find holes in those junctions. And a motivated government intelligence agency can and does find those holes.
But why did the U.S. government develop this thing in the first place?
Tor came out of a problem with the Internet. That the U.S. government found. I mean, so it goes back to the 90s when the Internet started expanding around the world and kind of becoming the dominant form of telecommunications, right? So the Internet became the system that everybody was using. And, of course, the government was using it too. But there was a problem because the way that the Internet is designed, it's a kind of an open system in that it allows anybody who's watching a connection to see where a connection is coming from and where it's going. So if you're a FBI agent sitting in an FBI office and you're browsing the web and you're looking at, I don't know, animal rights forums and you know, pass yourself off as an animal rights activist. A administrator that runs that forum, you know, if he sees, you know, you're coming in from this IP address, he checks the IP address, oh, it sees it's coming, it's a government network, and actually it maps to the FBI. So, anyone who's watching the Internet can sort of see the identity of government agents that are using the Internet. And so the U.S. Navy started to look at solutions to that, a way of, again, disconnecting sort of the origin of an Internet connection, right, to its final destination. And so what they came up with in the late 90s was something called Onion Routing. And they built something called the Onion Router. Tor, that's what it stands for, the Onion Router. It's a system that allows anonymity on the internet. But what they found out was that if only spies used this system, or if only FBI agents used the system, well, then everybody could see that if you connected to this network, then you were probably some kind of U.S. government agent. And so what they realized in the early 2000s was that you needed to open up the system, to open it up to as wide a group and audience as possible. So everybody used it, including spies. And so that then would allow spies to hide kind of in the crowd in plain sight. And so that's what happened. So the U.S. Navy privatized essentially this project and handed it over to a nonprofit, which still runs the Tor project today.
And now, also, we see a lot of people try to use Signal to encrypt their text messages. What's the story of that thing?
Yeah, well, you know, Signal is a encrypted chat application that you can download for your iPhone or Android, like any other app. And it's supposed to encrypt your messages to make it impossible for anybody to read it. The problem with, you know, Signal is that it's pretty much like Tor, in that it gets funded by the U.S. government completely. 100% of its funds, as far as we know, come from the U.S. government. And the money comes as part of a kind of Internet Freedom division that is run by the U.S. government. This Internet Freedom division got a huge infusion of resources during and after the Arab Spring. And the idea behind it is that, you know, you want to create fund technologies that allow activists in foreign countries to use the internet to organize themselves and sort of, you know, to create large-scale protest movements. And that is what Signal comes out of. It gets funded by that program. It's administered by Radio Free Asia, which is part of the Broadcasting Board of Governors.
Which itself was a some sort of CIA spinoff, essentially, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Broadcasting Board of Governors actually was started out as a CIA program that started in 1948 that ran these covert radio stations like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty and Radio Free Asia. And then in the 70s, they kind of, because they were outed by reporting and in congressional investigations, and these what used to be covert CIA projects that ran propaganda radio stations essentially became kind of legitimized and became part of the U.S. government officially, and were no longer covert, but they are an extension of that, a direct extension of that.
I'm speaking with the journalist Yasha Levine. Well, so I suppose someone listening to this might say, well, it's kind of cool to take this thing that the U.S. government developed to foment revolution abroad and use it to foment revolution at home, or at least resistance to Donald Trump. You have some political problems. I mean, leaving aside all these technical issues, you have some political problems with this this focus on encryption, right? What's your critique?
There's a couple of different critiques. I mean, one of the more relevant ones, you know, with the upcoming J20 protest, is that I know I'm seeing and I'm hearing from a lot of activists in America that, you know, there's a big push to get activists on this encrypted on these encrypted networks like Signal and using these apps to communicate. I wonder, you know, why is today's activist culture so focused on crypto and operational security? I just don't understand, you know, how encryption and left-wing politics, how they mesh together. As far as I understand, you know, mass politics and encryption are contradictory in themselves, because for mass politics to exist, you need to attract as many people, millions and millions and millions of people to your cause. And worrying about encrypting, you know, your strategy and encrypting how you're going to plan to march on the Capitol during inauguration day, I mean, is not really solid politics. If you're so paranoid about the cops reading your chat messages, it doesn't seem like you're going to build a big movement that's open to a lot of people and it'll attract people to it. From what I can tell, a lot of political movements today are actually just kind of protest culture in disguise, right? So people are, I think, focused on using crypto and tools like Signal to organize, you know, a rally of some kind, or to organize maybe, a closure of a highway or a closure of a street, which using Signal will give them enough space to organize and carry the action, right, before the cops come down and arrest everybody. But there's a bigger critique as well, which is this idea, right, that the people who promote these apps and the use of Tor and the use of Signal to fight government surveillance, in a way, they're proposing that people use technology instead of politics, right? It's this idea that we can solve the problem of state surveillance or the problem of police surveillance or surveillance by intelligence agencies by using technology. Technology is where the answer is to our political problems.
Well, this sort of fits in what you mentioned earlier, that the guy behind Silk Road was a libertarian. A lot of this stuff fits in with a libertarian ideology. It's like a secessionist individuals or very small groups. It's not focused on mass agitation to change the world, which is what you usually think of left politics as. It does seem like a more libertarian streak, doesn't it?
Exactly. And crypto politics or crypto... The crypto movement, I mean, it comes out of a strain of libertarianism that sort of, you know, crypto libertarianism that started in the 90s. It was a group of people that got together through the internet, through listservs, this sort of cypherpunk that they became to be known as cypherpunks. And they, you know, they kind of promoted an idea of the idea that encryption will destroy government, that you can create electronic systems, computer systems that will completely hide themselves from the government, and you could, you know, use it to escape laws, use it to escape taxes, and create these kind of islands of digital private property that were completely safe from government intrusion, and the government could not do anything to stop it. And so this movement, you know, had a big effect on Julian Assange, who was a part of it when he was younger. It had a big effect on one of the principal promoters of Tor and encryption as politics, Jacob Applebaum, who is kind of no longer part of the movement because he was accused of sexual abuse and over many years in the community. But yes, I mean, a lot of the people who are affiliated with these tools and who promote them and who make them come out of a libertarian ideology, a kind of crypto libertarianism that believes that you can replace the government with technology, and that you can, in fact, technology is something that will replace governments completely.
This sounds a lot like the worldview that brought us Bitcoin, too.
They come out of exactly the same movement. Because it's an anonymous currency, right? And if you really want to stay anonymous, you have to kind of anonymize your web traffic, right? So if someone knows you're going to this website and they can see you place the Bitcoin purchase, right, on a website that is traceable to your real-world identity, it's no longer cryptocurrency. Not fully crypto, because it can still be traced to you. People can see you make that transaction, right? Bitcoin actually depends on Tor completely to really give you the full anonymity and to give you that full cryptocurrency. Bitcoin really only became huge because of Tor and because of these hidden services, these websites like Silk Road that could run on Tor. You could use Tor to hide the fact that you're going to Silk Road. And on Silk Road, you're hiding the fact that you're actually paying for something by using Bitcoin. And so there are the multiple layers of this crypto that's on top of each other. And they are, ultimately, they come from the same place. And even on a deeper level, is that they're all funded by the U.S. government. And so, you know, it creates this funny situation, right, where you have these really radical, rabid libertarians who want to destroy the government. But the tools that they're using to destroy the government are actively funded by the governments they want to destroy, and more specifically, the U.S. National Security State and the spy agencies that they supposedly abhor.
That's very funny. And this all sounds a lot like Peter Thiel and his secessionist fantasies, too.
Exactly, yeah. It's Peter Thiel's secessionist fantasies and his fantasies of creating these floating libertarian islands off the coast of California where you could, you know, they would be moored right in international waters where you could, and then you could use them to get around, you know, pesky labor laws in America and the pesky issue of taxation. And you could essentially run these, I don't know whether you'd like sweatshop coding utopias right off the coast of San Francisco. These are the same kind of islands that people want to create by using this crypto technology, right? So you have a site like Silk Road, which is essentially a libertarian utopian island, but it runs on the internet.
Well, we've got Peter Thiel perhaps joining the Trump administration formally, or some kind of advisor to Trump at least. And we have all these activists trying to evade scrutiny by the Trump administration. I don't know. This just all gets very confusing, given the intimate role of the U.S. government in developing these tools, and at the same time the politics of Thiel and Trump. It makes the head spin.
when you start getting into crypto politics and the way that crypto politics has sort of come out of the libertarian right, but it has infected sort of the progressive left in America, and it's a confusing mixture of things, you know, because in many circles, right, you have apps like Tor, like the Tor Project, and apps like Signal, you know, they have a progressive image, and it's associated with progressive causes like civil liberties, free speech, you know, political activism, human rights, things like that, right? But when you look, when you drill down into the origins of the software and on how and look at how it's actually used, you see that these tools are used for some very unprogressive causes by the U.S. government. They're used for surveillance, for intelligence gathering, for regime change. These tools represent the soft side of, you know, humanitarian interventions and American imperialism. And so when you start to dig into it, not only is it hard to investigate and to unravel for yourself, it's hard to talk to people about it. And it's hard to get a grasp on it because it has these wildly opposing sides. On the one hand, the image that, that these technologies have, and then the other, the ways that they are put to use.
To switch gears radically for the last couple of minutes, you're in Russia, and have been for several months. How is this this American insanity, especially among Democrats, about the mighty Putin controlling our elections, the mighty Putin controlling Donald Trump, how's this playing in Russia?
I mean, like a carnival, I think. To be honest, I think people here can't imagine that America would get so crazy and so and become so insane so quickly. I mean, it's like a carnival show, you know. And I think people, in a way, are cheering for it because it's funny, and it makes Russia seem cooler than it is, and more dangerous than it is, and more important than it is on a global stage. People here in Russia have a lot of their own problems. It's many of the same problems that that America faces these days, in fact. And people here that I talk to that are not in the government, that are not journalists, that are not somehow connected to this or have a professional opinion on it, I mean, they are dumbfounded and really can't believe that it's serious.
I feel the same way, but I don't know. I feel like a minority. Yeah.
It's another way that I think Russia and America are becoming closer and closer and closer. What's happening in America, actually, is very similar to what happens in Russia, you know, where the news is no longer taken seriously by a lot of people. But then by a lot of people, it's taken very seriously, and it whips them up into a kind of a nationalist frenzy. And so there's this kind of a carnival aspect to the news and to what you hear in newspapers and what you hear on TV, right, is that you always have to kind of read between the lines and you never take anything really seriously. And then you look down at those who might take this, what they hear, on seriously, right? And so I do think that America is kind of turning into Russia in a lot of ways, not just on the oligarchy level, but on the way that the news media is kind of turned into something that you can't really believe anymore at all.
That was Yasha Levine. His book Surveillance Valley, about tech and snooping, will be out late this year from Public Affairs Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Fingerprint File by the Rolling Stones. Apologies for the boomer cliche. Next, from hiding to showing off, the culture of celebrity, something most political activists and intellectuals don't take seriously or even hate. Elaine Tobin, an assistant professor in the Liberal Studies program at NYU, thinks we should all take it seriously. Elaine Tobin. Just before we started recording this, we heard the news about Chelsea Manning's commutation, and you said there's an interesting celebrity angle to it. Could you talk about that as an intro to the topic?
The importance of Chelsea Manning's sentence being commuted has a lot to do with the fact that she was able to make press all the time, which was, you know, make paper, as they call it in the industry, which was really important. She wasn't left behind like someone like Geronimo Pratt, who's been largely now abandoned by the young left, or Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's really not a cause celeb anymore. Chelsea Manning, in part because of her gender transitioning, and in part because I think people don't feel her crimes in any way merited a 34-year sentence, and because of the documentary made about Snowden and about Julian Assange, and about, you know, there's this just entire kind of economy of WikiLeaks and Glenn Greenwald and a new emergent sense that we want people who are whistleblowers to have a chance to be free citizens in the United States without the outcry of that, and also large activists' calls for Chelsea Manning to have her sentence commuted or to be pardoned. So activism really worked in this case. I mean, it really, really did. I don't think Obama would have considered doing it. I thought it was a very, very bold move on his part, I'm going to be honest, leaving office.
I was shocked. I didn't expect it out of him.
I didn't either. I almost don't quite believe it. I almost kind of want to just go back yet again and make sure that this is confirmed. It's exciting news. It's complicated news, but it's exciting news. And I think that maybe can get us into a discussion of how celebrity has gotten us this past year where we are, but also the topic of celebrity studies should cause us to look backwards a little bit at how celebrity has played a serious role, not just in presidential politics, but should be considered a really important form of intellectual inquiry rather than like the most debased form of social knowledge, which is what I think some people think of celebrity studies.
Well, certainly your average intellectual will scorns it. You know, it's just shallow and stupid and a diversion from the things that really matter.
Right. I remember doing my dissertation in the 90s, and my topic was biography in middle-brow culture in post-war America. And my advisors, who were fantastic, but said to me, like, this is hilarious. You really think middle-brow culture is important. There's like 5 books on it. At most, I said, yeah, I think it's super important. I think it informs every element of our kind of lived experience at this point. I think celebrity culture is thought of as only Hollywood culture, which is not true. Celebrities exist in almost every realm now, and they have for a very long time. I think the early writing on celebrity culture, which was really, to my mind, well, Chaucer, but more recent, Leo Lowenthal, who was part of the Frankfurt School, who wrote The Triumph of Mass Idols, which is really largely ignored when people talk about the Frankfurt School, where he looked at statistically what kinds of press sold on what kinds of figures and how we were moving away from historical figures, figures related to the military, figures related to politics, and more into athletes and spokespeople. And it was a really important study, and almost no one cites it anymore.
I think Mills talked about it in the Power League,
yes,
right?
Mills did.
Kind of trivial.
And to be fair, there was a brief kind of flare-up of discussions of middle-brow culture and celebrity in the early 90s. There has been a lot of great work done in the field. Richard Dyer and a bunch of people, maybe we can do a link to the radio show on a bibliography because it's boring to do here, but I think that the field has kind of been defined by 2 basic tendencies. Sociological tendency, so let's look at what social psychologies and what sort of social movements and social textures lead us to be interested in celebrity. And then a Laura Mulvey kind of school of semiotic studies of celebrity. Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema, her famous article, where we look at stars as texts and signs of psychoanalytic impulses and sources of pleasure. That's changed a little bit since the 70s and 80s. Now I think there's a more hybrid, interdisciplinary approach to celebrities that goes beyond either simple sociology, simple biography, simple psychoanalysis, and into complex understanding of stars as a series of texts and as a series of economic realities in the world that we live in. The other reason I think it's really important is that intellectuals really can't afford at this point to not engage in the world that a lot, the majority of Americans, I'm an Americanist, so I'm going to specifically focus on America. Celebrity plays differently, of course, in other places. But that the majority of Americans spend much of their working day engaged in, which is watching television, engaging in celebrity culture, certain forms of fandom, reading tabloids, reading people, reading us. Looking at the way that people get married and break up and get involved in particular cultures, and it serves as a moral compass for people as well. So to ignore it seems to me, I don't even want to use elite because that sounds elevating. It seems stupid.
According to the BLS time use surveys, adult Americans have an average of 5 or 6 hours of leisure a day, and they spend about half of that watching TV. So we're talking 2.5-3 hours a day, 21 hours in the course of a week. So
right.
That's, you know, a lot of time, almost half as much as they spend at work.
And I think a thing that's, as a professor, that's really interesting to me is to watch how deeply affective my students have in their identifications with particular stars, whether they're in the cinematic realm, the musical realm, the YouTube realm. You know, there's micro-celebrity happening everywhere as well, so we're not just talking about the George Clooney's of the world, or, you know, we're also talking about people that you and I wouldn't know to watch. People who live in dire poverty often have televisions more expensive than mine, and we have to pay attention to that fact. They're looking at television. It's an aspirational narrative in the minds of many people. It's important to understand why that matters. It's important to understand why people care about Angelina and Brad, why they might not care about it, but nonetheless, it's still everywhere. Being a celebrity and staying a celebrity, that takes more than a village. That takes a huge industry, and it has for a very, very long time. So it's worth paying attention to, and I think most people who listen to your show would agree with that. I always get a little nervous when I meet an academic or an intellectual or a lay intellectual who says to me, I don't have a TV, I don't watch TV. And by which they don't mean I watch TV on my device. They mean I don't watch it. And I'm thinking, how can you be a citizen of the world at this point and have that be the case?
It's mysterious to me. I
actually don't know if I can go out to dinner with those people. I don't. It's like saying I'm 45 and I've never seen Zoolander. I don't know how you can. I know that you don't go to films, but
we have a TV there.
You have a TV. What does it mean to say I don't have a TV as a point of pride? I guess it means you sit home and read really big books, which is super important, but it also means you haven't thought about what McDonald's means or why, you know, people drive.
Before going further, you know, I think it was a crusty old neocon who defined celebrity as being famous for being famous. What do you mean exactly by a celebrity? How is it established?
Well, I think we actually have to parse that out, and it's a really excellent question. Most people knee-jerk response to celebrity now, you know, in the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years, they think, like, celebrity is a flat category, Paris Hilton to the Kardashians to George Clooney to the Clinton. Like, they're all just the same thing. And I don't think that's the case. I think that celebrity has changed. It's not a new phenomenon. It's been around for over 2,000 years. Leo Braudy in The Great Frenzy of Renown wrote about this. You know, you start out as, you know, Caesar to be a celebrity in the Roman Empire meant to be a warrior. That was the only possible route. And, of course, there was no television. There was no media. So you had coins and statuary, and that's how people said, like, I guess this is what my leader looks like. I guess this is what Caesar looks like. I'm going to trust this statue in the middle of my town. Flash forward, you know, finally we get photography. So people get to see what Abraham Lincoln looks like, and they get to see what their actual leader is. And then we get television, so we actually even have more of a firm belief that there are famous people who we can photograph moving in time and space. It's a little more convincing than just the flat image. And then you have the rise of Hollywood, and then the rise of television, and, you know, I should add, moral panics follow each of these developments, right? There's a moral panic after the advent of photography. There's a moral panic after the advent of film when you have these faces of silent film stars, huge in front of audiences, and you know the famous narrative of everyone running out of the theater the first time they see a train coming at them in film because they don't understand it's not going to bust through the screen. So there's like actual adjustments to the technological development of cinema itself, and fame comes as a part of that. Silent movie stars, because you couldn't hear them, had to have a certain sort of visual effect that then later, when the talkies were introduced, shifted. You didn't have to have quite so much deep close-ups. You didn't, you know, you could rely on dialogue. And so the star text kind of changed, and a lot of celebrities were left by the wayside during that transition. So that's the Hollywood part. So for me, the Hollywood part of celebrity is somebody who has name recognition and visual recognition across a relatively broad spectrum of the population. Relatively broad. There's micro-celebrities at this point as well, and people who have small but dedicated followings. Then there's celebrities in the realm of sports, in the realm of politics, in the realm of business. I mean, we have, you know, the Zuckerbergs of the world and the Gateses, and right, so celebrity business people. And I think they're all celebrities, but they all function in different ways. I don't think Mark Zuckerberg functions as a celebrity in the same way that, say, Angelina Jolie does. I would imagine, and I haven't done a concrete study of this, but when people think of Mark Zuckerberg, they're going to look at him as an entrepreneurial capitalist celebrity, that somebody who was able to disrupt and make the system work for him and became wealthy for that reason. Angelina Jolie, they're going to look at as someone who's beautiful and maybe talented and who runs around the world putting out horrible humanitarian fires, or at least dousing them with a light tea.
Her magic
hose.
And beauty.
Right. So I'm not even sure the definition of celebrity matters as much as paying attention to how that's playing into particular parts of social formations and capitalist and social reproductions and the contradictions therein. And celebrity for leftists is a really good place to look at contradiction. I mean, it's a rich part of the celebrity culture, because celebrities don't really work unless we both feel that they are our new secular saints, but also feel that they function just like us in certain particular ways. And People Magazine and Us Magazine and In Touch and all those tabloids actually understand that contradiction really beautifully. I'm a little obsessed right now with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. They're both the perfect couple that have now fallen apart because they tried to form a non-traditional family, which they were, you know, years ago the perfect couple for trying to form the non-traditional family. Now they're the perfect couple that fell apart because they tried to form a non-traditional family. And the reader or the audience member is asked to figure out how to embrace both of those realities at the same time.
I'm speaking with Elaine Tobin, who teaches in the Liberal Studies program at NYU.
Before.
Well, there's this fascinating contradiction. There's a magazine that says celebrities are just like us, and they're taking out the garbage and walking the door.
Yes.
So yeah, and at the same time, they live us in this enchanted realm beyond our, you know,
they pump their own gas.
Yeah.
And yet they're dressed at the Golden Globes and in an outfit that's more than the per capita income of.
So what does that do for us? Do we want to be both?
Now we're getting into sort of a psychology that I'm a little bit uncomfortable with, but it's you, so I'll riff on it. When I ask my students at the beginning of the celebrity class that I teach, which is called a Celebrity, a Historical Exploration of Fame in the Global Brand, so it's about looking at how fame develops over a very long period of time, how many of you think that you'll be famous in a sort of way when you're an adult? 75% of the kids raise their hand. They mean by Twitter, or they mean literally, I'll go on YouTube and become famous and become a fashion designer or become a performer or become an actor. And these, I'm not in Tisch. I'm in a liberal arts program. So they're wildly aspirational in this regard. They also think that democratization of celebrity means they have a shot at this and that they can monetize it and it will be lucrative and it will be a real thing in their lives. So that's the 18-year-old perspective. What I think we can do with it right now, and I'm so depleted since the Hillary ascendancy and then the Trump election that I'm a little pessimistic about what we can do with it. But I think one of the things we can do with it is not dismiss it, not to say, like, it doesn't matter at all what celebrities do vis-a-vis practical politics, because it actually can matter. Bernie was... His organizers were very aware that getting Mark Ruffalo, Sarah Silverman, Rosario Dawson, you know, like those mattered as endorsements for him, and my students paid attention to those endorsements.
But now Hillary had all these big names and it didn't really work for her.
Hillary's big names sucked, though. They were deeply, people felt deeply ambivalent, as you know.
Katy Perry.
About Katy Perry and Lena Dunham. I mean, deeply ambivalent. I was so sad when Katy Perry and Russell Brand broke up because I was like, he's kind of awesome. That was a sad moment for me. So, but anyway, she has these sad, single, kind of vapid creatures as her celebrity endorsements. Bernie's people are at least kind of funny, lefty, Jewish, Hispanic, mixed race folk. Did Donald had like Scott Baio?
He doesn't have too many people.
He doesn't really have too many. And, he can't even book the Bruce Springsteen cover band.
I was just going to say that. He lost the Bruce Springsteen cover band. When you lose the cover bands, you really...
We are at the waning end of the Weimar Republic right now when you lose the Bruce Springsteen cover band.
But some people would say that's his strength, that the you know, Hillary's, and Democrats in general, attraction to celebrity is kind of elitist, and Trump is, by being so detached from that celebrity culture, is really, you know, man of the people. He's the populist.
Well, A, he wasn't detached from it. I mean, as Helene Owen argued, he won in part because of that, right? Because people love You're Fired. And
he is a celebrity himself.
He's a celebrity himself, even though every New Yorker hates him for that, and his embodiment of that is so crass and gross and disgusting and banal. But he is a celebrity, and Hillary was a celebrity. The problem with Hillary as a celebrity is she doesn't have any real qualities of a celebrity. She doesn't have any charisma. She didn't take that part of the job seriously. I mean, you're following Barack Obama. Say what you will about Barack Obama. He's a charismatic guy, and I'm ambivalent about charismatic presidencies in general. I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing. But she didn't have any real platform. She had nothing energizing about her. She was the dullest form of celebrity candidate you could have. I was shocked that the Democrats decided to run her. I mean, everyone knows this about her. So I guess I would say in her case, she's like the worst underbelly of not understanding what celebrity is and attaching herself to figures that, I mean, Katy Perry's interesting. Some of her songs are fun. She's not galvanizing a political base. I mean, no celebrity endorser's really going to do that. But at least Mark Ruffalo shows up at, like, Standing Rock. He has better politics than some of my colleagues have.
If we had somebody like Noam Chomsky here, you would step in and say, well, you know, all this celebrity stuff is just a distraction from the really important material. He would lament the fact that so many people are as obsessed with celebrities as you say they are, which, of course, they are. That's an undeniable fact. I mean, you know, he said they should be, like, you know, getting involved in politics instead. What do you say to that kind of left critique?
Well, I would love if Noam Chomsky would weigh in on that. The people who follow Noam Chomsky would be right to say that. But
of course, Noam is a celebrity himself.
And Noam is a celebrity himself, but I think a celebrity with integrity and someone I respect, and I wouldn't discount his view. I would just say, you know, you can argue that, but you're fighting against the, like, rushing tide. Like, I don't know what, you know, why you think this isn't an important thing. You can't get through your day without this. I can get through a day without somebody talking about Hegel. I get through weeks and weeks, in fact. I can't get through a day without celebrity culture impinging on my life or making me or the people around me think about, even for a nanosecond in the grocery store, think about, you know, how the social order is constructed. And I also would say, and this is going to probably be unpopular, we get a lot of hate comments on this, we make fun of these people, like, they know how to unionize. In 1933, the Screen Actors Guild unionizes to fight against the big motion picture industry, making them have these terribly long contracts, etc. People like Bela Lugosi, I mean, they have a brief, horrible stint with Ronald Reagan as head of SAG, but they're an incredibly powerful union. They know how to get people paid for, like, plugging in a light to an electrical socket. Like, they're really strong union. They have over 300,000 members, if I'm correct at this point. We laugh at them. Universities, my university doesn't have a union. We have an adjunct union. Our faculty is not even unionized. So there's a reason during the Cold War and during McCarthy blacklist era that they went after Hollywood, because they were terrified of their ability to unionize. In the 2007 television writers' strike, you know, everyone except late-night TV shows went on strike. They know what solidarity is. They didn't cross picket lines. They were pretty powerful in this regard. One could argue football players and certain athletes also know how to do this. it's the left that doesn't really know how to do this. It's like these guys know, laugh all you want, you know, Bela Lugosi, blah. He knew how to unionize. And so I think that...
Well, of course, he's Bela Lugosi, whereas, you know, your random burger flipper could be replaced by another random burger flipper.
Right. My point is, like, let's look to see how they did some of this stuff. Because all the union people weren't that famous. I mean, some of them were writers who weren't actually known to the American public and didn't even have their name on.
But as you say, there's a lot of solidarity.
There's tons of solidarity.
Which is missing in a lot of conventional labor.
They may have sniped at each other occasionally in gossip columns, but they knew who their enemies were and who their friends were. And I look at Facebook these days, or I look at Twitter, and I'm like, really? You think this person who has a minor, a 10-degree disagreement with you is your enemy, and you're going to call them these horrible names? They're not someone who has opposite views of you, not somebody who you really think is a horrible person, but someone who literally is just like a tick away from your beliefs, and you get into a raging Twitter war. So maybe Noam would say they're a distraction, but I would also say, like, let's figure out how they manage to have a walkout that changes the entire face of the industry, which leads to reality TV, sadly, and also to The Apprentice, and also partly to the Trump presidency.
Yeah.
Let's learn from that a little bit. Let's not cast them aside completely. I don't want to overemphasize celebrity. I don't think Sarah Silverman or Mark Ruffalo or Lena Dunham or Katy Perry can win an election. But I think young people who, if I'm correct, in the 18 to 25 vote, Trump took five states at the most. That's it. They're the future. And we need to pay attention to what they're paying attention to a little bit. And what they're paying attention to is celebrity culture in interesting and complicated ways. The other thing I think I would want to add is, when I look at the left, and people like Noam Chomsky, don't have to worry, he's already a very well-known person, in my opinion. He's a hardworking dude. He's earned everything, his accolades. But the left is super aspirational as well. Like, right, a lot of people on the left want to be influencers. They want to be well-known. They want to be famous. So when you look at a lot of this left infighting, a good chunk of it is because they're like, what happened? How is Jacobin becoming really popular? Why is Chapo really popular? Why aren't we the influencers? Why are those guys the influencers? Like, it's a fame hunt as much as it is anything else.
And it's a pretty small pond.
It's a tiny pond. It's a tiny pond. But I think people exempt themselves from that. You know, oh, I don't want to be famous. I'm purely for the struggle. I've met like 3 people in my life who are purely for the struggle. Most people want to be purely for the struggle, and it's not a bad thing. They also want to be influencers because they feel they've worked hard, they've thought about things, they want to change the world, and in order to change the world, you can't just sit in your mom's basement and post it on Twitter. You have to actually have a presence.
One final question. Jody Dean talks about the decline of symbolic efficiency, by which he means that in the old days, you know, there were the big studio movies, there are 3 networks, people read a daily paper, so we all had the same points of reference. And now, with the internet in particular, just so many more micro environments, and I imagine the celebrity world is similar. It's, you know, it used to be big stars, big TV stars, big movie stars, and now you've got YouTube stars and Twitter stars. And like, what difference does that make to how we process celebrity?
I think it's fragmentation and overproduction. I mean, I think we're facing a crisis of overproduction in certain ways. It's really hard to form community groups when you can't have touchstones of culture that you all agree are significant. Part of it comes down to kind of capitalist realism. Like, what can happen in a 24-hour day with labor, and then depending on your bourgeois or working class hat or whatever, the amount of leisure time you have, how can you fragment that out? How much can that fragmentation be solidified? I mean, I don't mean overproduction in the classical Marxist sense that there's a huge crisis of capitalism vis-a-vis this, but we're approaching that, I suspect. And I think that because of that, the things that do draw us together in the collective moments of contemplation are often really perilous, right? So I watch Trump's tweets because I'm fascinated that he is so bad at this and weird at this. But then I think, okay, I'm watching the tweet. So are a bunch of people who are to the right of me watching this tweet. That's the only thing we're sharing in popular culture right now.
He's got like, what, 20 million followers or something?
He has 20 million followers, which, you know, is a lot of followers. It's also the amount of people who are on the Affordable Care Act. So it's, I don't know.
That's how many people are going to lose their insurance.
How many people are going to lose their insurance? I don't want to say that I don't buy this, that like we're in a, our society is dumbing down because of celebrity culture, and I don't think people are becoming more debased. What I do think is that the literature and the language of debasement and fake news and hyperbole have started to enter the political arena in a way that we haven't quite seen since, like, the tabloids of the late 19th century in New York, like, where headlines were as ridiculous as they are now, and candidates said things as crazy as they are saying now. There's a history to it. It didn't just pop up recently. What did pop up recently is social media explosions, and intellectuals have struggled to grapple with what those explosions mean and what that fragmentation means. I don't think we know how to look at it yet. Maybe we need to take a little time, figure out the political scene on the ground right now, save our lives and the lives of our fellow citizens, and then, like, figure out what some of the lessons of the collision of politics and celebrity have been.
I was Elaine Tobin, an assistant professor in the Liberal Studies program at NYU. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song about our current predicament, money, success, fame, glamour, by Felix de Housecat versus Pop-Tarts. Till next week, bye.